This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. It's Friday afternoon, it's pouring down outside.
It is pouring.
And that means that consultant urologist Dr. George Lee is in the studio because he's brought the rain with him.
Oh, Xiaoyik.
As Mira always says.
Well, actually, I can get used to this, you know, Xiaoyik asking questions. I know this is our third show together
yep,
and everything.
Yes, yes.
So it looks like, this trend is here to stay, right?
No.
Mira
will be back. Don't think.
Talk about the rain, right? It's a bit disappointing. It's like tomorrow we're going to have this. I think tomorrow is Ed Sheeran's concert, right?
I have no idea.
You have no idea.
No.
Come on, you've got to be a bit trendy. It's like a lot of people worried. Like, how can we
do it? I'm an old soul.
You're just. Anyway, let's talk about what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, we're going to talk about oral herpes. We have the best topics when you're in the studio, George.
Absolutely.
So just wanted to pick up on some news that came out. Last week, a woman allegedly contracted oral herpes from a lipstick sample at Sephora. This is not in Malaysia, though. But while she reached a settlement with the makeup giant, it did lead us to wonder, should people be freaking out over oral herpes and over an alleged mode of transmission in that manner? So we'll be discussing this and some of the misconceptions about oral herpes. You can call us with any questions or comments that you have. The number is 03-7733-2900. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Mm-hmm. We have Dr. Elias Lee, general practitioner with the Community Healthcare Clinic of PT Foundation in the studio with us. And we're hoping he will help to shed some light on oral herpes. So, Dr. Elias, perhaps we can start with a brief explanation of what is the herpes simplex virus.
Okay, well, the herpes virus is actually part of a bigger group and they're quite related to each other, but there's herpes type 1 and type 2. Mm-hmm. And these two are normally what we call the herpes simplex viruses. And, you know, you have the other kind of herpes virus, like the varicella zoster, the one that causes the chickenpox and also shingles.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, all right. So herpes simplex is the one we're talking about today. And you've said two types. So what are they and how do we distinguish between the both?
Well, actually, there are two types, namely type 1 and type 2, but very easily named. The thing about these two types is that merely academic difference, you know, because they do affect similar areas, although people say that type 1 normally is in the oral area and then the type 2 is normally in the genital area.
I like the way you say normally. Usually there are some, you know, caveats to it. Would you like to explain a little bit? Because I think people get extremely sensitive if once we use herpes, the words, right? Okay. And of course, some people want to tone it down a little bit, call it cold sore. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, well, it is the same thing, actually. You know, if you go, a cold sore is some lesion on the mouth. And that's what we call it. Like, and you can see kids having it all the time. And this is essentially a herpes simplex infection.
Mm-hmm.
And type 1 and type 2, people do say that normally, but nowadays because we are seeing more and more cross, you know, it does not mean that it's exclusively in the areas of the genitalia for type 2, or nor does it, like, type 1 is going to be exclusively in
the oral
area. Mm.
So what I'm trying to get at is that, so type 1 can commonly affects the mouth, but actually type 1 can manifest itself as genital herpes. Is that correct?
That's right. So,
yep. Okay. What are the kinds of... because, George, you probably see genital herpes among your patients more often than not.
Very, very common condition.
Yes. So how do these patients usually present?
Okay. I mean, this is extremely distressing for a lot of patients, you know, because sometimes you see all sorts of ulcerations arising from your private parts, and sometimes it can be a simple thing like a infected hair follicles. Sometimes it can be as serious as a syphilis, and then when they have something like that manifest on their private parts, and obviously patient who recently or in the past had been naughty will probably feel a little bit anxious and then would come to see me with clarification. Mm. And indeed, it is not so easy, because a vast majority of them will probably look up the internet and then with all those images and they say, this really looks like herpes. And so that is the situation that I usually get my patients presented to me. Would that be the similar situation that you get patients present to you when they were a bit worried, a little bit about ulcerations in their private parts?
Well, most of the time, if they do come in that way, it's mainly the first time ever getting such a lesion. Or other than that, it's like maybe they're coming in if they're unsure. I'm not sure what I have it right now. Mm-hmm. So it could be, is it an ulcer even, or is it just a normal cut? And so or some people think that it's a syphilis or something. Mm-hmm. And then we do get people coming in with lots of cold sores, but they normally don't notice that. It is just something that's normal to them. And,
and usually it's quite painful as well, right, if it's truly a herpes, both type 1 and type 2.
Yeah, if it's the first time ever getting it, it's really, really could be excruciatingly painful. Yeah, but after subsequent attacks, it normally gets milder.
So you've mentioned first time getting it and then, you know, subsequent ones. So is this something, is it an infection that stays with a person, and will it recur over and over again in life?
Yeah, I guess that's why people are so afraid of herpes, I guess, because it's an infection that is not curable. So if you get infected by it, it lays dormant in the body, and so it goes in the nerve endings, and then it just stays there. And finally, when your immune system drops, for whatever reason, it could be like stress, it could be it could just be a long day, and it comes at interruptions. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, essentially, this is what you said, right? People get really wound up about it. Number one is that the name herpes is usually associated with being naughty, right? Okay. Number two, it is just like a disease that is never going to go away, because you're just going to live with that. Mm-hmm. In reality, it can be perceived just as a skin complaint that will never, ever cause you any life-threatening consequences. Would that be a true assumption?
Well, the most part of it is quite benign. There are exceptions, of course, like extremes of ages, like small infants and really old people, and people who have low immune systems, then they do somewhat pose some danger.
Such as?
You can go inside the brain, for example.
Oh, right.
Meningitis, herpes.
Okay, yeah. So you can get viral meningitis, but that's exceedingly rare.
Exceeding rare. You'll never see one at any point, you know, like, but we do know in infants and really old people. And people who already immune system have already dropped, and we do see it.
So if that's exceedingly rare, and it's a disease, it's a skin complaint that comes and go according to your immunity, it just has a really bad stigma that attached to the name herpes. Why are people so wound up about it?
Well, I guess people think that, you know, if I caused you this, or you're going to blame me for this. It is an infectious disease in the first place. But, you know, what people don't realise is it's so common. It's really common that almost everyone has it.
Exactly.
I have some numbers here. According to the World Health Organization, about 2 out of 3 people under the age of 50 have the type 1 infection. And so that's 3.7 billion people worldwide. And for
that's
type
a lot
2,
of herpes.
Yeah. That's right. And for type 2, it's 417 million. I don't have the ratio for that. But yes, exceedingly common. And, you know, Dr. Elias, you mentioned that even kids can get it.
Mm-hmm. Where does it come from?
Yeah, at the same time, you know, we are worried about it being a sexually transmitted infection. How exactly is it transmitted?
Well, it's by contact. One of the kids' aunties or something, oh, what cute little child picks it up, and, you know, like,
Let's say a baby gets it. It could potentially be a mother who has got cold sore kissing the baby.
The thing is that with or without a cold sore, this is the tricky part of herpes. You can actually get viral shedding without any lesions seen.
So all the babies born presumably will have no herpes.
Hopefully. Yes.
Right, okay. And then somehow an auntie with or without cold sores touching the baby, kissing the baby, and in a Chinese custom, probably warming up the food in the mouth in the mother before feeding the baby.
Yeah.
So that the usual kind of like a, you know, every time my mother kind of does that, I kind of thought, oh, my mother, you grew up with
this. Here's a public service
Don't do that. Would these be a typical way of transmission that, let's say, a five-year-old kid will get herpes in their mouth?
Absolutely. And, you know, when you turn one, what happens is you take every single thing, put it in your mouth, and then, you know, that's the other way.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you might self-induce, pick up the virus from somewhere and then just put it in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And typically in children, how do they manifest itself, type 1 herpes?
Well, just a little cold sores, maybe a blistering, and the first time, you know, it can be quite unpleasant, but then after a while, it just comes out, and then
You know, when this happened to me, my mum just say it's heaty lah.
Yeah. Right? So, how do you distinguish it from other types of mouth ulcers? You know, the types that you get with hand, foot, and mouth, or just normal oral ulcers.
Or heaty ulcer.
Or heaty ulcer. There you go.
Well, I guess if you look at the child and then you see that they're practically quite healthy. They're still running around. They're still, you know, we might not like to take their foods and so on, but other than that, they're quite okay. And that's probably just herpes.
Yeah. I mean, so therefore, this particular lawsuit that is, you know, a woman claiming that, you know, using the lipsticks samples, presumably in a store, that actually has the virus passed to her.
Yes.
How feasible is that? You know, how long does the virus stay on the lipsticks? How quick after the lipsticks being used? How does she prove that she had this infection? You know what? This probably can open up to the listeners out there in this pouring Friday afternoon.
Yes. Call us at 03-77-332-900. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll be finding out more about that question that George just asked. Can you get oral herpes from trying on lipsticks?
Or sharing your water bottle with somebody, right?
Absolutely, just touching anything, right? Yeah. It would seem that we are all at risk. 2 out of 3 people potentially have herpes. We have 3 people in the studio, so
share
do
each
the math.
Other's disease.
Do the math. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist in the studio, as well as Dr. Elias Lee, general practitioner from the Community Healthcare Clinic, PT Foundation. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. It's Friday afternoon. That means Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, is in the house for the Doctor in the House segment. Mm-hmm. And joining him today is Dr. Elias Lee, general practitioner from the Community Healthcare Clinic of PT Foundation. Today we're talking about oral herpes because there was news last week that a woman had reached a settlement with a makeup giant, Sephora, over a lawsuit where she claims that she contracted oral herpes from a lipstick sample at one of their stores. So before the break, George, you wanted to know...
Asking the question, that's right. Well, first of all, do women share lipsticks like samples in their stores?
So with lipsticks, there are samples.
Right.
I have never heard of anyone who would apply them on their lips.
All right, because
you would test it on the back of your hand, for example. But you know, the question is that could virus be shared?
That's right. It's a fair question, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
This case, right? The case, first of all, you know, how do you prove that she didn't have it in the first place? Secondly, how can the virus actually survive in the lipsticks independently and then between one host to another? And number three is that how deadly is this for her? And then that will demand and warrant a lawsuit and compensation.
Mm.
Well, I guess, you know, anything is possible, if you want to say.
That's so politically correct. Anything is possible. Okay.
However, I think the real scenario is probably she had herpes already in her mouth.
Yeah, because, you know, there's 2/3 of the world population or something, adult.
Under the age of 50, yes. And it's possible that she had it without knowing it because she didn't have any symptoms,
right? That's right,
So, but how, if there was virus on the lipstick, how long can it stay on a surface like that?
Well, it's hard to say, actually, because I think Well,
it depends on how expensive the lipstick is. Sorry.
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say. But then, like you said, you know, like there are sometimes we do know that we can transmit herpes through objects like spoons and so on. And then, but that's quite immediate, I guess. Not something that stays on for the days and so on, hours.
And, I guess in theory, you wouldn't need to apply the lipstick on your lips just for it to transfer. If, like I explained to George, if you're just putting it on your hand or anywhere on your skin, the virus can transfer as well.
Well, theoretically, there is a possibility, but it's not going to transfer to your lips then. It's going to transfer to your hand.
Right. So, can herpes virus infect somebody's hand or torso, any part of the body that is not exactly the mouth, the genitalia or the anus?
So it's not that common, but it's known to happen in very rare cases.
Yeah. Ah,
okay. We do have a question on WhatsApp. M is asking again about transmission of herpes. Some years ago, there were a few case reports on transmission of herpes from toilet seats during a transatlantic flight. Uh-huh. So any views on this?
Well, it doesn't have to be specifically transatlantic, right? Right. Any toilet seats at all. Doesn't even have to be flight. So how likely it is that somebody actually contracted herpes through infected toilet seats?
I guess, you know, think about it. Like, you know, if people have never used public toilets before and then they're using it for the first time, then there's a chance that he or she contracts herpes. Mm-hmm. However, we've been using public toilets all our lives. So
does that mean that if you are exposed to public toilet, especially Malaysian ones, then you built up some sort of like barrier that you will never get it? Would that be a fair kind of like a assumptions from what you're saying?
What I mean is that you probably got it way earlier.
All of us probably have it already.
Yeah. So the toilet, you know, the infection was way back when you were 5 years old rather than when you're 49, right?
That's right.
So, I mean, you know, I get this all the time. Like when patients come to me and say, look, I haven't done anything naughty. Why do I get not just herpes? Sometimes people turn up with gonorrhea and chlamydia. And then, you know, I kind of like try to say, look, there is no other way this can be transmitted, especially gonorrhea and chlamydia. Mm-hmm. And then, but somehow we have to settle for maybe it was the toilet seats, the door handles, or the dirty towels in that cheap hotel. Mm-hmm. How likely is it that, you know, infections like that get transmitted through common things
everyday
that we touch?
Objects, yeah.
Well, I guess for the case of herpes, probably more common than the other.
The other one. So chlamydia, gonorrhea, most likely not possible, but herpes, maybe.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Because another question on WhatsApp is, can I get oral herpes if I share drinks with friends or if food in restaurants are prepared by someone with oral herpes?
Great question.
Mm-hmm. Well, not just friends, I guess.
Presumably, you're not sharing food
friends,
with strangers.
So, I mean, especially in our Asian culture, right? You know, we share all our dishes together. It's like sometimes I go to Hong Kong and they're horrified that they have a common pair of chopsticks that everyone, you know, don't touch the food, and then you have your personal chopsticks. And I was like, in Malaysia, we use chopsticks, everything. We mix everything together. It's all communal. So my Hong Kong friends are horrified. So can you please categorically say that what is the likelihood of transmitting any form of infection and categorically herpes?
Well, to be honest, you know, we don't really have that data information, but I'm just sounding like a nerd right now, you know, but I do see that actually we don't have that many cases of herpes coming manifesting like cold sores and so on.
That's right.
As it is. We don't go around every day seeing everyone having one or two lesions here and there. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's not that debilitatingly common. Mm. But, you know, people do have herpes in them, and most of the time they just go around their normal lives
without knowing it.
There's no symptoms.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting you mentioned that, because the other question that I really want you to clarify is that you mentioned that, you know, the auntie can potentially transmit it with or without any visible cold sores. Is one form more contagious than another? So when you have visible cold sores, will you be more contagious than when you have no visible symptoms at all?
Well, yeah. That will be the plain answer to it, yeah. Because, you know, when you see something, then you know that it's there. Mm-hmm. But if you don't see something, it doesn't mean that it can't transmit. Mm-hmm.
But speaking of, you know, the infection where it's asymptomatic, you know, the sores have not developed yet, what triggers the symptoms to develop? Is it when your immunity is low, as you've said, you know, such as in the case of the chickenpox virus, mm-hmm. Which can trigger shingles later mm-hmm. on? Is that the same?
Yeah, in a way, yes. And sometimes immunity drops because of stress. It can be because of another infection, for example. You know, if you have a cold and it comes out again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you see this as well. Like, you know, they come in like in the genitals where you see mm-hmm. another infection and triggering the outbreak of a herpes infection.
I mean, we started a program with you highlighting that this is a big umbrella group of viruses, mm-hmm. including chickenpox, shingles, cold sore and genital herpes. If you contracted one, would you be more likely to either get a recurrence of the others or more likely to get a reinfection of other forms of virus? Because if they are from the same family, would it kind of like a cross-infect and then have a similar pattern of infections?
No, they're quite specific. They're quite specific in the area. So, you know, if type 1 is type 1, type 2 is type 2,
mm-hmm.
and then you have your cytomegalovirus, your herpes, it's all different.
It's all different manifestation That's and right. different pattern of infections.
That's right.
Okay.
So, George, when a patient presents mm-hmm. with genital herpes, what are your treatment options
okay,
for them?
Okay, right. This is the part where we're going to get really technical and quite exciting, because we're going to get people probably calling in. If you're a bit embarrassed, you can always say, my friend, right? Okay, I have this problem. Okay, so this is what I'm really hoping to get some clarifications, right? When patients come in with a little bit of lesions in the genitalia, then obviously the worry they have is to get genital herpes. They tend to do these blood tests. I would like you to, for the benefit of listeners, can, you know, talk about the blood tests of herpes type 1, type 2 antibodies test.
Mm-hmm.
And then they always have these range of equivocal, negative and positive. And how sure are we? Because I don't use those tests, but they are quite prevalent being used, and I think that creates some degree of anxiety for patients. Would you like to elaborate that?
Well, this test, the antibody test, they actually test not for the virus itself, but the bodies produce antibodies. So we have IgG, which is it shows that if you had been exposed to herpes or any whatever form, if you're testing for herpes, you'll test IgG. And then if you have something more immediate, something more acute, it's probably IgM.
Mm-hmm.
So what role does it have in our clinical practice? Very little, actually. Because what it creates more is to create people more anxiety.
That's right.
And, you know, the likelihood that it's going to be positive is going to be so high that, you know, it's not necessary.
Yeah, okay. So what you're highlighting is that even if your blood test is positive, it doesn't mean that you've got active herpes. And then is there any kind of like a, if let's say in the past you had chickenpox before, will your antibodies be elevated artificially so it's showing a false positive?
No, well, I think it's still going to be herpes. It's quite common to have herpes in the first place.
All right.
Yeah, so because of that, you know, the antibodies
will be elevated anyway.
Yeah.
So, okay. So the next question is that in my practice, I do the DNA test in mm-hmm. order to just do a swab, and then you check for the herpes virus DNA test. Mm-hmm. If half a population, you know, many people, billions of people actually have got this, is it even worthwhile checking? Because you looked at it and you cannot say, but sometimes patients want that clarification. So how accurate are PCR DNA testing? And then also, would they ever disappear whenever you do another swab test?
Well, I think there is a role for PCR DNA testing where you see that this is very specific and it's very sensitive. So you can pick up an infection.
Mm-hmm.
If you see an ulcer, you're not sure if it's syphilis or if it's a herpes, or it could be something else.
Mm-hmm.
Just using that little swab and taking a sample will really give you a lot of information.
Right.
So as a screening tool, I don't think...
You don't think that's good. Okay. Yeah. So most people, if a man has got, let's say, ulcerations and it's herpes, is it likely to be, most likely to be herpes type 2 in the genitalia? And in how likely it is to herpes type 1 to manifest in the genitalia?
Well, that's the common thought about it. You know, say in the type 2 will be more common in the genitalia, and in type 1 will be more common in the mouth. However, we do know that this interchange can happen, and we might just see that there might be more and more on crossover, I guess.
So, does it make a difference, yes, whether it's type
exactly.
1 or type
Great.
2?
Purely academic.
Yeah. But it makes a difference to patients' perceptions, because if you actually say that, you know, oh, this one is co-sore and the other one
is the sexually
transmitted infection, that terminology itself, it's crucially important for certain patients because, you know, it's certain connotations that are attached to it.
And does your PCR DNA test distinguish
between the two? Yes, it does. Yeah,
it can, yes.
Even though the transmission, mode of transmission, because herpes simplex type 1 itself might even be sexually transmitted.
Right.
However, because of that clarification or that distinction between one is sexually transmitted infection, the other one is more likely to be associated with co-sores, sometimes that is a really important differentiation between patients, because there's some sort of accountability. It's always needed, and especially some degree of explanation to the partner.
Because you do need to, I suppose the action after that would be for that patient to inform the partner that, you know, that because it's to do with the mode of transmission, right?
Well,
their sexual partners, for instance.
Well, I guess the responsible thing would actually be to inform your partners of all your STIs and so on. But in the case of herpes, however, it's not so much of a sexually transmitted infection that we are concerned about. It is yes, sexually transmissible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can get it quite commonly in other ways as well. So you have to highlight that part. That
yes.
If someone has it, it's not necessarily, you know.
Yeah, so therefore, awareness is crucially important. Saying that shows like this to actually highlight several things, like how common it is. And then also you highlighted earlier on that with age, the manifestations of the disease itself decrease. And then also, whether it's type 1 or type 2 is academic and the treatment is completely the same, and then it's never or exceedingly rare to be life-threatening. And
but
then,
what is the treatment?
Yeah, okay, let's talk about the treatment.
Well, we generally give prescribe antivirals, and I think the conventional acyclovir still holds quite well, although there are newer ones that are coming out on board, and the acyclovir is still is quite effective, and it's cheap, and the course of 5 days course, and they should clear up on most of the symptoms.
And can it recur again after the course of treatment?
That's right. There is a possibility that it recurs, because that doesn't really get cured. It goes inside the body again.
Like you said, it's dormant.
So the trick is that actually if someone's had herpes before, they want to, like, the minute they have a hint that it's going to come up again, that's when they really need to go and get their meds. Because the longer you delay, the more extensive it becomes, and the longer it takes to heal.
What's your view of antiviral in a form of tablets versus antiviral in a form of cream?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what would you advise your patients to do whenever you get patients presented that way?
Well, if I have patients coming in for, like, first time, second time, and when you see how often they come in, well, sometimes I'll give them a whole course for them to keep at home. Or tablets, you know, just start it before they immediately, if they feel something, a hint that it's coming out again. Some do like the cream, but in my experience, that the tablets are the most effective ones, and the cream's just nice to have at once.
And these will solve both the oral and genital manifestation of the virus?
That's right, anywhere.
All right, so it makes no difference whether it is type 1 or type 2.
Okay. We are talking about oral herpes today on the Doctor in the House segment with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, as well as Dr. Elias Lee, general practitioner from the Community Healthcare Clinic PT Foundation. We'll be right back. After the break, I'd like to explore a little bit about the link between oral herpes and, or rather, herpes simplex virus and HIV. There is a connection there. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, whether pregnant mothers are at risk and what they can do to protect their babies. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, Ti Xiao Yik. It's Friday afternoon, so it's our Doctor in the House segment, and of course, consultant urologist Dr. George Lee is in the studio, as well as Dr. Elias Lee, general practitioner from the Community Healthcare Clinic of PT Foundation. And we've covered quite a lot of the basics about oral herpes, and really the most, the thing that has really come through is that it's exceedingly common. According to the WHO, 2 out of 3 people under the age of 50 have it. A lot of the times it's asymptomatic. We won't know that we have it. And it's, George, it's a viral infection, mm-hmm. almost like any other, isn't it?
You know, in many ways, you know, if you want to put it mildly, you just call it, you know, heatiness, right? Okay, right, get it? And then, you know, if it appears in the genitalia,
yes,
then you just call it skin
places.
Complaint, right? Yes. Okay, so in some way, a lot of us actually are quite happily oblivious that we are harboring this virus. And of course, there are certain times it matters, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So early on, we talked about people who are distressed and then, you know, stress, and then that might emerge. And then you highlighted that take the antiviral, 5 days later, it disappears until the next time you mm-hmm. put yourself under that sort of situation. But it's not so simple for somebody who is HIV positive. And then also, it's not so simple for a pregnant mother. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, for someone who's living with HIV, I guess there is a bad relationship between her HIV and herpes, where they do interact with each other. So someone who has a herpes would actually pick HIV more likely to be infective and as well as bring down their immune system, and vice versa. Like, you know, someone with HIV will probably get infected with herpes much easier.
Okay, and presumably in PT Foundation, you know, because this is an organization supporting people living with HIV, mm-hmm. You would be seeing a lot of patients presenting with both. Are there any unique challenges to managing patients living with HIV and, you know, managing their herpes infections?
Well, most of the time people coming in with herpes and this is one of one-off thing, and if they do have HIV, just mm-hmm. one-off, and you treat them and they find they go on their way. Mm-hmm. But then there are times when actually that infection does linger, the symptoms do come back quite recur quite often, and so we might need to treat them a few times in a few months, mm-hmm. and after that maybe we might consider doing suppressive therapy,
yeah.
which is to give them this constant supply of antivirals, keep it in the system, so that they suppress the infection and doesn't come out.
For how long?
You know, a few months, actually. And then we give them a try to a break and see whether or not they come back out when we stop the treatment. And most of the time, it does just stay away.
Is herpes more debilitating in somebody with HIV?
Yes, in some way, yeah, it is.
Yeah, so early on, you mentioned about herpes might be causing meningitis and other things. Would that be more prevalent in somebody who is immunocompromised?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
We have a caller on the line, Shafika. Good afternoon, Shafika. You have a question.
Hi, Shafika.
Hello, hello, doctor. So I have a question. If herpes is so common and it's dangerous for babies, should we not allow strangers or other adults to hold or touch our babies?
Good questions. You know, we mm-hmm. highlighted certain fear.
Thank you very much,
and then, so we need to clarify that.
Well, I think it would be criminal to say that we
that you cannot hold.
Well, actually, first of all, Shafika highlighted, she said that it's herpes is dangerous for babies. Is that a true statement? I'm sorry if that is the kind of impression we give out, but yeah. Is that true?
No, it's not. It's like if someone who's like a preterm baby, premature, and you know, there might be some.
So, if the baby has got immuno defense mm-hmm. deficiency, mm-hmm. might just be more dangerous to have that. But a healthy baby in the pram being pushed around in the streets, yeah. I mean, even though a stranger who has got a roaring cold sore in their mouth is not really going to transmit, it's not really going to cause a baby any harm, would it be?
Yeah, that would be the case.
Okay. Yeah. So if I get, it's okay. I think the strangers, as long as they are somebody who's quite safe looking,
yes,
will be all right for
I
your
would
baby.
Think, I would be cautious about letting strangers hold your babies, but yes, it's not a huge cause for alarm as far as herpes is.
I think these days we also should practice hand cleaning hygiene. I think before anyone touch your baby, just make sure that they wipe their hands and use it.
But speaking of babies, George, we also wanted to find out more about what happens when pregnant women contract herpes during her pregnancy. Mm-hmm. What is the risk of transmitting it to her unborn baby?
Mm. Well, I think herpes is more when the person is going into labor. So if a mother has active lesions, we tend not to advocate for normal vaginal delivery, but instead you have to do a C-section.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be foreign.
What would be the danger of insisting on vaginal delivery?
Because it does cause quite a lot of concerns and damage to the baby.
Right, okay. In what sense? Probably hit, cause eye inflammations or mouth or anywhere. It could be anywhere, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Could it lead to mortality?
That's right. One of the causes that we look up for infant mortality is actually herpes infection.
We have a very good question on WhatsApp here. Are there any measures we can take to prevent herpes altogether? Because although it is common, the stigma around it is still very bad.
Yes.
And if some of us were to get a flare-up, how do we explain that to people we work with without them feeling disgusted?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So prevention, what kinds of precautions can somebody, if we know we have herpes?
Let's talk about oral first, right? Mm-hmm. So if I don't have oral herpes and I know I've checked my status and then my partner has got herpes, and is there any way that I can stop myself from getting it?
Well, there is a possibility because if your partner has it and you've not had it for years, no recurrence and so on, the likelihood you're going to get oral herpes is quite low.
Mm-hmm.
And keep your partner healthy. So, you know, don't stress your partner out.
but
that goes for everything.
You know what I'm saying? But what you highlighted earlier on was that with or without the ulcer, the transmission, it's potentially going to be there. So does that mean that if I avoid kissing my partner and I will may not get this infection?
Yeah, but you're going to lose out on a lot of things.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about, in relation to that, barrier techniques, condoms. How protective is condom against herpes virus?
So, true answer is that it's somewhat protective. It's not fully protective. They do offer some protection, I think. But here we are talking about a device that has been around for quite some time, and you're supposed to be really careful with it at the point of time when you're not so careful, made by nature. You know, so it's got to be somewhat.
Okay.
But and also the sores could be in areas that are not protected by a condom.
True. Mm-hmm. Right.
And contact with those sores would
unless you use very big ones to cover the rest of it. Right. Okay, I mean, do you have any statistics, let's say, you know, figures of transmissions? Because I'm sure there are statistics about transmissions rate of HIV with condom. It's probably like, you know, 1 in 10,000 or something like that, right? And then is there any statistics for virus protections if one uses condom for as far as herpes is concerned?
Well, in terms of HIV, you know, we're quite... We know that the data is quite well fixed.
Such as?
So 3% for receptive anal intercourse, for example, that would be the exposure rate for...
Right, 3%. Okay.
3%, and that's the highest we get from sexual intercourse. But for herpes, it's a bit grey, it's very iffy.
What about oral sex? Somebody wants to know on WhatsApp, can herpes be transmitted through oral sex?
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about it like type 1, transmitting from one direction, and then type 2 transmitting the other direction.
Yes, and that would be the normal way that that happens. So type 1 going down in the genitalia, and then the type 2.
So from oral, transferring to the genitals?
Yes, through oral sex.
Oral sex,
right. Okay, so that is quite easily contagious that way.
It is, yes.
All right.
And can it cause throat cancer is another question to follow up.
No, it's not.
No, it has no association with cancer at all. And then that is HPV, that is commonly thought to cause transformations of the cells, which potentially carcinogenic.
That's the human papillomavirus, which is, of course, linked to cervical cancer in women. But, you know, we earlier on in this conversation, we talked about how there are many different types of herpes virus. And that's where I think people are getting confused, because varicella, zoster, the normal chickenpox virus, is a type of herpes virus as well. We also have a question on WhatsApp about whether, well, there's a link to a very long manuscript here, and the question is whether herpes HSV6 and HSV7 can cause Alzheimer's.
Wow.
So
we
what is
very
HSV?
Very intelligent listeners out there who really want to find out association with Alzheimer's.
And this is, just let me give some background, it's linked to a new landmark study published in the journal Neuron. So, Dr. Ilias, what is HSV?
Six and seven.
It's a different kind of herpes virus from different groups, and not the two that we're discussing today, which is simplex of what we have today. But yeah, this study has been mentioned that, you know, people with Alzheimer's may have.
I'm sorry. Actually, let me correct the listener, because in the article it's actually a human herpes virus, HHV, not HSV. HHV 6A and 7.
Is there a difference between herpes simplex virus and human herpes virus?
Yeah, entirely different viruses.
Okay.
Okay, so this is probably
different family of virus we're talking about. And that's the interesting thing. It's like commonly people are looking at what we thought to be benign viruses that in perhaps long term might be associated with conditions such as Alzheimer's disease.
Yes, something to keep our eye on, I suppose. There's just so much we don't know about Alzheimer's yet. But I wanted to quickly ask, since herpes simplex is so common, why don't we have a vaccine against it? Would it be a good public health method?
Well, short answer that we haven't found one yet.
We haven't found one yet?
And I wish we did.
Okay. So if there was one...
That would out of jobs.
there's a lot more you can do.
That's right, okay.
And if there was one, and I know that there's efforts being made to research the development of vaccines for herpes, but would it be a good public health strategy to give it to everyone?
Well, I think for vaccines to work, you have to give it to quite a large number of people. Because, you know, for it to work at some level. So, the answer will be yes.
Well, I guess for vaccine to be worthwhile for the taxpayers' dollars, normally we looked at how common it is. It's very common. How deadly it is, it can potentially be. About how troublesome it is in the society, I think that part itself, because although it is not deadly in the medical sense, but it is deadly in a psychological sense, I think though that alone, it should really have all attempts to be eliminated.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in the meantime, we work on eliminating the stigma around it.
Of course.
Yeah. We are running out of time, but Dr. Ilias, do you have a final message about oral herpes?
Well, I think oral herpes is something that's common. So do not be afraid of it. If you see someone with a lesion in the mouth, don't run away. You don't necessarily want to, like, go up and kiss them, but just don't run away. And for all purposes, maybe we've got it all our lives, and we just don't know about it, and it's perfectly fine.
George, your message.
I think just treat it like hitila, and also I'm also very happy that rain has stopped.
Oh yes, it's clear
now. I think it's
now.
Just going to be like this tomorrow when we get to meet Ed Sheeran, right?
Yes, good for you. Good for you, George. We've been talking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Dr. Ilias Lee, general practitioner, from the Community Healthcare Clinic in PT Foundation, and we were talking about oral herpes. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.